This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. Today, we're beginning a series of occasional profiles of notable, significant, and fascinating people in our region. And today, that person is a new member of the Connecticut House of Representatives, Corey Paris. We'll get to my conversation with him in just a moment. Right now, we're going to check in with our senior political reporter, Ebong Udama, for an update on what's going on or what's going down, I guess you could say, at the state capitol. Ebong joins us via Skype. Ebong, hello. Thanks for taking time today.
Thank you, Tom.
One major issue that lawmakers have been debating up in Hartford is the Transportation Climate Initiative, referred to commonly as TCI. Could you remind us, what is the TCI exactly?
It's a multi-state compact, and it's aimed at dramatically lowering greenhouse gases and other emissions from transportation. At the same time, bringing some badly needed revenue into the state's transportation system. And also, it would help out with underserved communities that have been disproportionately affected by the impacts of climate change. Connecticut will join Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and the District of Columbia as the first jurisdictions to commit to the carbon cutting concept. TCI is a cap and invest program, and it'll bring revenue into the state about an estimated $89 million in 2023, and it goes up to about $117 million in 2032. And Republicans have...
Who is supporting this? The Lamont administration has signed on to this, I guess, back in December, but many in the GOP are not on board with TCI. Why not? What's the problem?
Well, the GOP say that it's another tax, and it's a gasoline tax. And they say it's $100 million more in taxes. And they say Connecticut already has two taxes on fuel, and this would be a third tax. And it will drive up gasoline prices and diesel prices and add cost to goods that are transported. As a matter of fact, Senate Republican leader Kevin Kelly is rallying support across the state to oppose this, and he calls the movement Stop the Gas Tax Connecticut Movement. And they've been holding rallies all over the state. They have rallies coming up this weekend and into next week, and I guess until they can try and kill this bill, and we'll see what happens.
So, since we're on the topic of money, what is happening with the state budget so far?
In April, the Appropriations Committee approved a $46 billion two-year state budget plan. And at first glance, it matches the spending level endorsed by Governor Ned Lamont in his budget proposal, which was at the beginning of the session in January. But the package makes some major new investments in higher education, social services, municipal aid. And it also taps about $240 million from this year's projected budget surplus and moves another $350 million in sales tax receipts to an off-budget account. And the dueling plans now become the foundation of negotiations between the legislative leaders in Lamont, and they have until June 9th to try and get a deal and pass a budget before the end of the session.
And how about the billions of federal dollars coming in from the COVID-19 relief bills? Lots of speculation how Connecticut will use that money. What are some of the ideas lawmakers are floating right now about that?
Well, most of the money will be used to enhance safety and try and fix some of the economic problems we had that were caused by COVID-19. But lawmakers and the governor want to also form some fund some new initiatives, transforming everything from healthcare to education to workforce development, even some infrastructure to better function, for the state to better function after the pandemic. The challenge is to ensure that when the federal dollars run out in 2024, Connecticut's economy will recover enough to pay for these new ventures and make the transformations permanent.
And finally, another bill that's been getting a lot of attention, especially what's been happening in the states surrounding Connecticut, is the marijuana bill, I guess, that would establish a recreational marijuana market in the state. What's happening with that right now?
Well, the governor has started off the session pushing for this, saying that he doesn't want Connecticut to be the only state that doesn't have some type of legalized marijuana, considering our neighbors have moved in that direction. But it's kind of, there's negotiations going on, but it's kind of hard to tell where we stand right now. The administration says it's up to the legislature, and the legislature says it's up to the administration. So it is kind of vague, but everyone seems to want to get to a deal. We're running out of time in the session. So this is what Speaker Ritter had to say a couple of days ago.
We can find a path to a deal. It is not, it's the kind of thing that I think you could always go into overtime if you had to.
that sounds like special session talk, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And we thought we wouldn't be doing that this year, since we have a surplus, and it's very likely that we'll have a budget deal before the end of session. But Speaker Ritter thinks that this is important enough, and this might not be the only issue. Sports betting might also be an issue that they might have to come back in a special session to deal with.
Another bill that is, I guess, has been passed by both houses and is sitting on the governor's desk is one that deals with what's been called prison gerrymandering. Could you talk about that for a couple of seconds? Let us know what it's about and if you think the governor will put his signature on it.
What has happened in the past is that during the census, prisoners are counted in the districts in which they're incarcerated. And that means that a number of rural districts in the state have a higher population than the regular residents because of the prison populations there. And that also counts when districts are apportioned, because districts are apportioned according to population. And these incarcerated people do not reside in those districts after they leave the prison system. They normally go back to their hometowns where they originally came from. So there's been this contention that it's unfair to the urban districts because they're losing population because they have so many incarcerated people, and it's a gain for rural districts. And Democrats have been pushing for this for quite a while, and they've finally been able to pass it, and it's going to the governor's desk for his signature right now. Republicans totally oppose this. They feel that it is unfair to those districts because the prisoners are counted, being counted in those districts means that Republicans might lose some districts when the next reapportionment comes around.
Mm. So this bill essentially counts the incarcerated people in the towns where they come from, not the towns where the prisons are, where they're incarcerated. It just moves the numbers back to their original hometowns, correct?
That's correct.
Hmm, okay. And the Republicans are against that, generally speaking?
Yes, they feel that that might Because basically districts are apportioned based on population, and that might affect some rural districts which are Republican.
I guess Ebong will be speaking with you likely when a special session rolls around in the not too distant future. Thanks for spending time with us today. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much, Tom.
Ebong Odama is WSHU's senior political reporter. This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. Corey Paris is the newest member of the Connecticut House of Representatives. And at 29 years old, he's also one of the youngest. Representative Paris is a Democrat from Stamford. He was sworn in last Tuesday, a week after he won a special election to fill the seat in the 145th District, vacated by Patricia Billy Miller, who is now in the state Senate. Mr. Paris has been quite active. He's development director for the Children's Learning Centers of Fairfield County, the vice president of Western Connecticut State University's Alumni Association, and he also was a national trainer for Young People 4, YP4, a People for the American Way program. He's the vice chairman for the Mayor's Multicultural Council for the City of Stamford. That's a role he was appointed to in 2016, I believe, by Mayor David Martin. And he's also on the board of directors for the Association of Fundraising Professionals of Fairfield County. Representative Paris enters the House, the Connecticut House, with an ambitious agenda for education, affordable housing, and access to voting, and he joins us now via Skype. Representative Paris, congratulations on your victory, and welcome to The Full Story.
Tom, thank you so much. This is an honor to be here and joining you this morning. I am a big fan, so this is better than winning the Super Bowl and going to Disney World right after, I'll have to tell you that.
Well, we appreciate that very much. And again, thank you for being here. In addition to the bio of sorts that I just shared, and there's more to that, actually, I'd like to add to that, pointing out you were born in Arkansas, raised in Kansas. You came to Connecticut to go to college, Western Connecticut State, in Danbury. Why did you choose to come to Connecticut for college?
It's a very good question, because if I remember correctly, my first year in Connecticut, it was rather challenging in the sense that there was every kind of weather phenom that had taken place that year. I think that there was a freak snowstorm on Halloween. There was an earthquake that earlier in that year. There was also a tornado. So I had a little bit of every region of the country in this one state, and I was thinking to myself, what did I get myself into? However, and I say that jokingly looking back, however, Connecticut has always held a very special place in my heart. I first traveled here when I was living in D.C., working for people for the American Way and YP4. A really good friend of mine at the time had been native to Stamford, and so he invited me to come visit, and I absolutely fell in love with it and would come back in my free time during school breaks and whatnot to visit, and decided that I wanted to become a permanent resident of our great state. And so I moved here to attend Western Connecticut State University. Not a lot of people in my family were very happy about that. My grandmother thought I was absolutely out of my mind because of the amount of snow that Connecticut usually gets, used to get in previous years. She thought that I would be trapped in snow. And so for many months after that, after me moving here, she sent me care packages with lots of Long Johns because she was so worried about all of the snow. But it has proven to be a wonderful place to not only grow professionally, but also a place where I look very much forward to spending the rest of my life.
It's interesting that you decided to stay in Connecticut. One concern that many legislators, many people in the business world too, talk about is how challenging it is to keep younger people in Connecticut, right, getting them to stay in the state once they've earned their degree. And you've explained your reasoning for that. Would you encourage others to think the same way?
Oh, without a doubt. You know, I think often what a lot of people fail to realize is that a lot of the young people who are leaving Connecticut or have thoughts of leaving Connecticut are folks who are born and raised in Connecticut. And I can understand that notion and that sentiment that you don't want to stay in the four corners or the borders of the place that you have always known your entire life. There is an entire world out there to be discovered. And I think that young people should be open and flexible enough to exploring those new places. However, there are a lot of reasons why people should stay in Connecticut. We have one of the highest quality of life factors in this country, right here in this state. We have good roads, great schools, wonderful opportunities to exploring other major cities within a 2-hour radius, if not less than that. Not only that, but the quality of life in terms of health and an average age of those who are living here, and they're living, our elderly population and aging population are living longer than a lot of other states. And also, it's a great place to raise a family. So I know that a lot of people want to say that there's so many people leaving Connecticut that we can't attract new businesses, that people are fleeing the state. But we've had more people move into Connecticut, certainly within the last year, throughout the pandemic, than we've had leave Connecticut. In fact, in Stamford alone, a lot of people were concerned about the fact that we have so many high rises, so many apartments available. Obviously, development is booming here, and so there are a lot of new places which are being built. And we've actually increased our rate of occupancy in Stamford over this last year. We were at 93% prior to the pandemic. We're now at 97%. So the notion that young people, that this is not a good place for young people to stay and to grow, I think is one that certainly needs to be debunked. And I certainly think that through my service and through my commitment to Connecticut, I hopefully will be able to share that with other people as being an example.
I know that education is something that's important to you, and
yes.
you also work, as I mentioned before, the director of development at the nonprofit Children's Learning Centers of Fairfield County, obviously education related. Could you tell us something about the organization and the work you do there?
Well, Tom, you're about to open up a can of worms, because I can go on and on about the Children's Learning Centers of Fairfield County. You know, we are a unique organization. We are turning 120 in later this year. As a matter of fact, we are the second largest early childhood education center in the state of Connecticut, and currently the largest operating early childhood education center in the state of Connecticut. We have 8 different sites across Stamford, serving nearly 1,000 families. Of those families and the children that do walk through our doors every day, for which we offer a comprehensive early childhood education platform. Nearly 43 languages are spoken. Nearly 96% of our staff are women. Nearly 89% of those women are women of color. So this is a really, really important issue that is very near and dear to my heart. I think that the investment that we're making in education on in the grade school levels and in high school and in college are critical. However, I think people have to understand that we could really live in a more resilient and sustainable society if we focus more of our efforts on early childhood education. And the reason why I say that is because between 6 months of age and 5 years of age for a child, 90% of their brain has already been developed. And so in this stage, what we do at CLC is that our teachers and our staff and our program directors are committed to not only working with the families and to ensuring that they have all of their needs met, and that they are also helping their kids grow at home, not just, you know, doing the, let's say, 8:30 to 5 o'clock at school, but that it continues in the home. But we're also helping the young children find ways to grow in a nurturing and stable environment, emotionally, mentally. We are one of the largest food providers in Southwest Connecticut, which a lot of people don't know. We feed our kids 2 meals and a snack nearly every day. And so this work is so critical because it also allows, it enables parents to go back to work, which we've seen has been a real challenge throughout COVID. They've had to choose between childcare options for their children or going to work to put food on the table. And that's been a rather difficult decision for a lot of families to make. So while we are helping folks from all different income levels and from many different programs, such as Early Head Start and Head Start. Our work is so critical to Stanford, and it is so critical to our state. And I think another thing that people need to realize is that 60% of the early childhood education centers in the state of Connecticut closed their doors last year because there was not enough financial support either from the state or from the federal government to help sustain their work over the last year. And so that is something that is really important to me. I think education is the key to us, again, having a more resilient and sustainable community and state for our future. However, I think that we need to start in making sure that we're making a huge and hefty investment in early childhood education.
During that period, early childhood education, what kind of education, more specifically, do you think is important? Are we talking about, you know, the ABCs, math, and whatnot? Is there an advantage to teaching kids how to, at that young, to socialize with people unlike themselves, exposing them to diversity sooner than later? Is that in the mix, do you think?
I think that's an incredibly thoughtful and insightful question that you're asking, and I think that you're absolutely right. I think that there is certainly an advantage to exposing young kids to diverse populations very early on. I think what you have to also realize is that a lot of people say that they have learned better, at least students of color, but further along in their academic careers have said that they've learned better from teachers that often look like them because there are shared experiences that they can lean on in those spaces. Now, if you think about this for us, and us being CLC, why this is important is because it allows for there to be a higher probability that the students that we are serving will better excel in school when they go to kindergarten or, you know, first through fifth grade, because they have already been exposed to these different diverse populations. The other thing is, too, is that we are incredibly encouraging of our parents to cut out a lot of screen time. I know that when I was younger, I read a lot growing up. My grandfather and my grandmother and cousins, they all read to me all the time, either albeit the newspaper or any book that was, you know, in our homes, encyclopedias. And I think that clearly there's a generational divide where there are a lot of young people, young children right now being more acclimated to screens and iPads and tablets of sorts. And while that's all good and fine, it does not necessarily develop a young person in a way that needs to happen, because there are often social skills that are lacking when there's more an intention being spent toward a screen. So I think you're definitely on the money with the fact that it is helpful. And I will point to one example. There was a school district in Chicago where it was majority-minority of young students, and there was a problem with behavioral issues with young students of color. And instead of doing what the school district had been often used to doing, which was just putting kids into detention or suspending them, and more than likely at higher rates, these were children of color, they put them in a room to meditate, to grow and get in touch with themselves emotionally, to talk about their issues, to talk about what was making them feel uncomfortable that caused some behavioral disruptions in the classroom. And over the next year, they saw the rate of suspensions go down dramatically, but it also allowed for some of those traumas that are often felt within their communities culturally or at home be dealt with. And so I think that that also starts here, and that's something that diversity, equity, and inclusion is at the forefront of our work at CLC. And I think that that's something that's obviously going to be beneficial to young people moving forward and also to our city and our state.
I'm speaking with Representative Corey Paris, newest member of the Connecticut House, a Democrat from the city of Stanford. Representative Paris, this is not your first time in the political arena. You were the president of the Connecticut Young Democrats. I didn't mention that earlier. I'm wondering, when was that, and why did you get involved?
It's a very good question. I've always grown up in a family where we were always expected to do something for the greater public and for our community, to give it back in some way. And so for me, you know, I think that we were living in a time where politics had just completely erupted into this major ball of divisiveness and confusion over the last 4 years. And not to say that that's not been present in previous presidential administrations, but I do believe that the Trump administration obviously ignited a sense of activism and also real concern among young people my age. My friends, certainly, who are all very well educated and very knowledgeable of issues that they care about, have not always been active participants in the political process. However, they have really leaned in more to understanding the electoral process, to understanding the importance of the census, of, you know, how that has complications with gerrymandering, which then has complications on zoning and education. You know, it's this big circle of life. So for me, I got involved with Young Dems because I wanted to ensure that every eligible young person that had the opportunity to vote was registered and certainly activated in that political process. So I began in this role as executive vice president about 2 or 3 years ago now. And my good friend, who's my predecessor, Constance Vickers, decided that she wanted to take a step back because she was doing political work in other arenas and in other fields. And so I ascended to the role of president, and I ascended to the role of president in a really challenging time. You know, certainly as an African-American person, I knew that it was very difficult as a Black man to be president of Connecticut Young Democrats and then also watch all of the uprise that was taking place with the Black Lives Matter movement, certainly with the murder of George Floyd. And how we responded to that in activating young people across the state. And what I have to say is that there were so many more people who were interested in getting registered to vote than ever before. I'd never seen that interest there before. We also raised a lot of money to try to build a campaign school to help teach Latinx and Black activists and women to learn how to run for office, run campaigns, and become activists in their own communities, because we think that, you know, you can't, it's not enough to just vote, but you have to be at the table to make those decisions. You know, Jed Bartlett, who is my favorite fictional president ever from the West Wing, said that decisions are made by those who show up. And I wanted to ensure that in November of 2020, that people showed up. And I believe that we did.
In 2018, I believe you challenged Terry Adams for his seat in the state house. That was in the 146th Stanford District. Adams, also a Democrat. Why did you decide to challenge him to go for that seat in the same party?
Yeah, you know, that certainly, I think many listeners will agree with the notion that that probably did not make me the smartest person in the room to challenge a sitting state representative of my own party. I have the utmost respect for Representative Adams. I think he has served not only our state, but certainly his district well during his time in office. The notion that young people have to wait their turn, it is frustrating, because I think that this is what has been the call to action for so long within my generation and generations prior to me in their youth, was that we should all rise to the occasion to answering the call to arms of serving one another, of doing good for our country and for our communities. And so I felt that in that race, I felt like it was a good time to get involved and to certainly advocate for the positions and issues that I care so deeply for, that I certainly will work toward fixing and pushing to the forefront in my role as state representative now. It was nothing, of course, personal, but it was definitely because of the passion. And clearly, it did not work out for me in that realm or in that cycle, if you will. But all things happen the way that they need to.
And then, of course, you ran recently and won the seat in the 145th district in Stanford because Patricia Billy Miller won her election, a special election for the state Senate. Now, again, this was all in Stanford. I believe at the time you were living in Bridgeport when you ran. Did you get any pushback since you weren't living in Stanford at the time?
Boy, Tom, did I ever. You know, and again, you know, I think that that's part of the political process, right? That people like to make noise about things. You know, it was a people have to understand, first and foremost, Patricia Billy Miller has been a giant, a titan, if you will, in the 145th district for many years. Her leadership has been inspiring, and certainly I look to her as a mentor and as a friend. She's been incredibly supportive since I became the nominee and thus state representative in the district that she previously served, and I certainly supported her in her race for state senate. I will say this, you know, I lived in Stanford for a very, very long time. I relocated partly because of some personal challenges, and I think also because of COVID. I wanted to be closer to friends and family during a time where a lot of us did not have that one-on-one interaction. And so we created our own little bubble where we would all check in on each other often. I'm not one to live my life by being politically calculated. I know that is silly to say as someone who is now an elected official, but I certainly did not relocate temporarily in an effort to run for office again. So I think it was used against me unfairly, and I think that people don't understand some of the laws that are made available to support every citizen of the state. So there was no law that was ever broken. In that sense, the law of our state does say that you can inhabit a dwelling in another city or in a different town and run for office somewhere else, so long as you move to the place for which you were elected from by the time that you were sworn in, which we did. And there are a lot of other state reps who have lived in that shared experience and have set that precedent before. So while it was incredibly frustrating to not have a race that was completely focused on the issues on the other side and how we were really, again, advocating for the families and for the young people and for the aging populations of our district. At the end of the day, this is politics and this is simply what happens. And I'm glad that voters saw through that. And certainly, in my opinion, I think they made the right choice. And I guess we'll have to wait until next November to see if they felt the same way.
And you did get the endorsement of the Stanford Democratic City Committee, I believe, in that race. But you didn't have a lot of time to campaign, March to April, roughly. How did that go? I mean, you had an opponent, Republican J.D. Ospina, I believe, and you only had a few weeks, really, to put together a campaign. How did that go? That's very unusual in this day and age in this country.
Tom, I don't think I've even processed the last 6 or 7 weeks of my life. You know, it has gone rather quickly, and I think that's the exciting part of it all, really, is because everything's happening so fast. You know, we knocked nearly 2,100 doors over those 6 weeks. Made voter contact and phone calls with nearly 1,000 people. We had supporters from all over our state and certainly from across the country. I mean, we even had a national committee member from the DNC here to help out with our race for a few days. It really was an amazing, not a moment, but it was a movement of energy and excitement. And truly, I think, within those 6 weeks, I learned a lot about the political process as a candidate because I'm so used to helping out as a volunteer or as a strategist, if you will. Certainly as a candidate, there is a split moment where you are always questioning whether or not you've met with enough people. Should you go knock on another door? Should you make another call? So it did move rather quickly, but having the endorsement certainly did help because I think it sent a very strong resounding message to the general public that our party was in favor of my candidacy and in support of the values that I held and certainly wanted, and certainly that helped for our district as well. So it will be the 6 weeks that I will never forget in all of my days. I, you know, toward the end, I jokingly tell people, and I would use this on the campaign trail, you know, I think a week before the election, I had, because I was also still working full time. So, you know, that's the other thing that I think a lot of people fail to realize about their legislators is that we still have to hold full time jobs outside of being full time legislators in a part time calendar for our state legislature. And so I was still working full time while campaigning 4 or 5 hours a day, plus doing call time 3 hours a night. And then on campaign calls first thing the next morning. So I actually left for lunch one day and just put my head down gently on the steering wheel and found my asleep And the only reason why I had awakened from that wonderful nap, which was my first time really getting sleep in a matter of weeks, was because I had disrupted my own napping by my own snoring. But that told me that we were really working hard and that it was all worth it because without that perseverance, I don't think we would have been able to have been as successful as we were in this race.
I'm speaking with Corey Ferris, the newest member of the Connecticut House, a Democrat from Stamford, representing the 145th House District, also one of the youngest members of the House, 29 years old. You're joining the House, you're joining the session, Representative Ferris, kind of late in the 2021 session, about,
sure,
what, 6 weeks before the General Assembly's regular session is scheduled to end. We've talked about education as a focus that you'd like to spend some time on. Another issue that you've highlighted is affordable housing. We focused a couple of shows, the full story shows in the past few weeks, on this issue. For you, what are the main affordable housing concerns that Connecticut needs to address?
You know, that's a great question, Tom. First and foremost, you know, you take Stamford as a prime example. Stamford's a great place to live. It's a great place to raise a family. It attracts a lot of young people. And there's a ton of support for development here, right? There's a lot of development that's happening. For affordable housing, for me, I think it's that we have to really look at, one, the cost of living in Stamford, and then two, how do we make that equitable for families to not only come to Stamford to live here, but for the families that have been here for many generations that are often being pushed out because it is becoming so expensive here. A few weeks ago, the State Bond Commission actually approved more than $49 million in state funding that would support the development of hundreds of units of affordable housing in towns throughout Connecticut. And of that $50 million, or 49 million, 50 million. Stamford was actually approved to receive 1.6 million for 34 units at a specific area in Stamford. So that is such an important accomplishment for us, and certainly my colleagues worked on this, and I look forward to working with them on these issues, because it allows for us to expand equity and opportunity throughout our great city, but also throughout the state too. I think affordable accessibility and sustainability is what we need to focus on. And the accessibility to that housing funds would also provide accessibility to healthcare and education and other services that are vital to progression within our community. So I think that these issues are really going to be critical in a sense that if we want people to stay in Connecticut, we have to ensure that there's fair housing across our state. I mean, for me, I certainly lived in a, you know, 900 square foot apartment a few years back, and, you know, was paying nearly $2,100, $2,200 a month for that apartment. And, you know, obviously you're living in the New York market. However, I think that there are other ways to find opportunities for people to live in the New York market, but not have to live paycheck to paycheck, which is something that as a young person, I feel all too well. You know, I watched recently on CNBC, you know, they talked about these various different generational groups. So, for example, you have Gen X and Millennials, and they actually introduced a new group named Henry. So it's high earners, not rich yet. And I often feel that a lot of friends, including myself and many of my friends, were probably in that Henry group where, you know, we are well educated, we've gone to school here, we're staying here, we're moving up in our careers, but we're not yet rich, because I think we're so bogged down by just the overall cost of living. And I think one way to make that more equitable for folks, again, is to start looking at affordable housing and sustainability.
You've also talked about a bill that would give tenants the right to counsel in eviction proceedings.
Right.
And I'm wondering, is this in anticipation of lifting the eviction moratorium, number one, and number two, do you think this is something you can work through, get done in the remaining weeks of the General Assembly session?
Yeah, you know, I've heard from a lot of constituents already on this one issue, and I think it is going to be a tough one where we have to be fair not only to the tenants, but we also need to be fair to the owners. And landlords. And I think that certainly COVID has put us in a position that is quite precarious, in the sense that We want to ensure that folks aren't falling into poverty, but we also want to ensure that there's not a loss of income for others that that might be landlords or tenants, and also with tenants. So, you know, I think that this is something that we can work on. We have had really long nights where we've been taking on and debating very critical, many critical issues and bills on the floor. I don't think that this is one that will be obviously something that will make everyone happy, but I think that fairness and equity is what is most important, and at least if people have the right to legal counsel in an effort to have their case heard by the judge, I think that that is probably the more practical and pragmatic use of time for many folks, instead of seeing many of our families out on the streets and living in poverty because of this pandemic.
And access to voting is something else you've talked about, a concern of yours, which, of course, is fairly high profile right now nationally because of what states, a couple of states, Florida, Texas, others have done.
Right.
Some have called it draconian legislation that makes voting more challenging in certain areas and for specific people. What do you think Connecticut needs to do to make casting a ballot more accessible to voters?
You know, Tom, that's a great question. And for us to be, you know, incredibly progressive on many issues, and we've led the way on many key issues across our state, and have, we've shown ourselves to be a true shining example for many others to follow across the country. Currently, I think people need to understand that 44 states in this country allow for voters to cast a ballot prior to Election Day, and 34 states permit voting via absentee without offering an excuse. So for us in Connecticut, we are one of six states where you have to have an excuse to vote, and that excuse has to be that you are not going to be in town. Obviously, because of the pandemic, people are far more cautious about going into big crowds and going to the voter, going to their local voting polling places to vote in person because of the pandemic, and people, especially aging populations, are at higher risk for that. I think offering the opportunity for people to vote, because we've actually seen that there have been more people who voted by absentee ballot in the last two cycle, in the last cycle, and also in the special elections that we've seen here in Stanford, without an excuse, I think that that offers a lot more opportunity for people to be involved in the political process. You know, the balloting and early voting and absentee balloting resolutions that have been put forth on the floor are extremely critical in ensuring that we do expand access to the right to vote. You know, I don't understand why we would want to make it harder or not just create more opportunities for people to vote. We, again, have some of the most restrictive laws in the country. And I would go one step further to saying in saying that we definitely need to make Election Day a statewide holiday so that, again, we are just offering another opportunity for people to get to the polls. We don't want there to be any suppression of any sort. And so early voting and no excuse absentee voting is that one thing that I do believe will increase civic engagement. And this is something that is obviously critical as we are trying to continue to uphold and expand upon our commitment to upholding our democracy.
You mentioned before that in your family, there was or there is a tradition of public service, of serving others. And I'm wondering, yeah, with all the ways that that you can do that, why politics, with all the division and vitriol that's happening right now? Why would a young person like yourself want to jump into that fray?
That's a very good question. Certainly a question that has been asked in our family often. I think it's obviously a real concern for two people in particular, and that's both of my grandmothers, who think that there are other ways to better to have a better use of my time, but I also believe it's because they hate to read things about me or hate to see me criticized. But that's obviously something that's something that is not only specific to me but to most public officials. So for me, I really do believe that it is important to be a decision maker and to be at the table, making those decisions and showing up every day and being a voice for those who identify themselves as being part of a marginalized community or being a part of a vulnerable population. I just think that those things that seem most challenging and putting yourself out there and being on the forefront, that's where you really need to be, because being on the front lines is where you get the most work done. And everyone has their part to play, and I believe that this is probably my part. And while sometimes it is a really uncomfortable space to be in, because you are often susceptible to so much criticism and so many attacks, there's also a lot of gratifying opportunities to work on a bill or work on a policy that will directly affect the members of any constituency that you serve or represent. And so for me, I truly believe that every person in this world, every person in our state, every person within the 145th district has the right to a fair and free life that includes equity, inclusion, really encourages a sense of diversity to our state and sustainability, and on that there can be no compromise. And I certainly want to be a champion of those people and of families across our state, and ensuring that we keep people here in Connecticut. We encourage other people to be like me in the sense of choosing Connecticut as their home, and also just leading the way for other states across the country to see us as an example on really smart, innovative, and intentional policy that's making a difference in the lives of people every day.
Is this type of public service in the political world something you see yourself sticking with, voters willing for years to come?
Voters willing, definitely 4 years to come. Six-week special elections, probably not. I will tell you that. I'm not a fan of those. But look, anything to be a servant and to the public, I think is what's most important. I think that this is definitely something that I see myself doing for a very long time, because there's a lot of work to be done to make way for the generation behind me, and certainly for those who are in the same age group as me, and also for those who are my elders and who have paved the way for my generation too. So I'm going to stick with this so long as I keep getting elected, but I understand that my thing is that I want to do a lot of good work and just want to keep my head up, facing forward, and focused on making sure that we're making every life better in this state on a daily basis. So that's my main focus.
Just one more question. I'm wondering,
sure,
outside of your family, is there someone who inspired you to dedicate your career to public service?
Wow, that's a really good question, Tom. You know, it's really interesting. There are a lot of people who have inspired me to jump into public service. I think one person in particular that I've actually been reading his biography was Sergeant Shriver, right? This is a man who came from a family and also married into a family that was overly politically active and did a lot of good for our society. But Sergeant Shriver was effective in the sense that he did not care where he was placed to do good work. It was just that he wanted to do good work. So obviously, you know, prime examples of his work and of his legacy, you can look at the work that he did in creating the Peace Corps, the work that he did with Early Head Start in terms of helping that piece of the great society, the work that he did in helping his wife, Eunice Kennedy Shriver, with the Special Olympics. And then, of course, he even dabbled in running for public office. So I say that he is an inspiration because it does not, just because you're elected to public office does not mean that you are more or less influential than Corey Paris, you know, 1 year ago, who was just the president of the Connecticut Young Democrats, and then also, you know, an active participant in many nonprofit organizations and boards, you know, helping in on the local level or in a more community-based level. It just means that there's always more work to be done. And if you get to grow in another space to have more impact, I think that obviously is telling of your commitment to people. And so he has been a real inspiration to me as of late. There are so many people, but that's the one that comes to mind first.
Representative Paris, thank you so much for spending this time with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you, Tom.
Corey Paris is a Connecticut State Representative. in the 145th District in Stamford. Do you have someone in mind you think we should profile? Tell us about it. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org. You can also catch up with us on Twitter at FullStoryWSHU. And that's it for our program today. Produced by Fatou Sangare and senior producer Ann Lopez, I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.